The Anton Savage Show on News Talk.
We have a cracking newspaper panel for you. All A-listers. Joan Burton, former Labour leader and minister. She represented in the Vineyard of Dublin West between 1992 and 2020, on and off TD and senator. Went on to be senior minister for social protection and Labour leader. Pat Farrell, who rarely admits these days that he was, back in Albert Reynolds' day, a head honcho in Fianna Fáil, general secretary of the party, but now is a corporate suit representing the chief executive officer of the Irish Institutional Property, which is about 20 of the biggest global investors in the property sector, and we badly need them for the housing crisis. And last but by no means least, author and top political analyst, many years with the Independent Group as political correspondent, political editor, and now head of content with Sunday Times Ireland, Philip Ryan. It's a pleasure to welcome you all. Look, let's be honest, it's mid-August, it's peak silly season, some interesting new stories, but generally here is the flavour of the front pages. The Sunday Indo leads with "Gain probe detectives in search for at least two weapons." This is the tragedy in relation to Mike Gain from Kenmare, who was murdered. And they're now looking for the weapons that could be involved in it. Major article by Joanna Donnelly of her time with Met Aaron and why she left. Would she be interested in the presidency? The Sunday Times, Philip's own paper, does have a significant bad news story, which is a 16th delay to the National Children's Hospital. It now seems that BAM will be pushing out the transfer of the building, which is only the precursor to actually getting staff and equipment into it, to the 30th of September. And it now looks like it'll be the winter of 2026 before patients could be moved from Temple Street and Crumlin to the NCH. And they're saying that's the wrong time of year to do it. We'll have more on that. The Business Post leads with a major interview with Jack Chambers, done by Conal Thomas, basically talking about, will we be able to do infrastructure this time? The money has been allocated through the National Development Plan, but the minister has a stark warning against the civil servants that they need to be less risk averse, they need to change, and he's saying that there'll be no protection for them. And finally, the Irish Mail on Sunday leads with 30 more claims against ogre brother Aidan. This is pressure from Children's Minister Norma Foley on the boss of St John of God, seeking assurances about safeguarding standards and more of the same. Philip, first of all, maybe you'd put some flesh on the bones of that Jennifer Bray story in terms of the National Children's Hospital. Yet another delay.
Yes, yet again. The dates, the handover date was supposed to be next month, the end of September. The handover doesn't mean it opens up. It means BAM says you can start putting equipment and you can start bringing staff over and then ultimately bring in the sick kids, who it's all about. But the latest row, which comes down to issues around the snag list, issues around when people can get into the hospital to do these various different things, now means that the opening of the hospital could have to happen in the winter months, which is something that CHI have sought previous risk assessment about to see if that's a good idea. They were told, no, it's not a good idea. It is a time with, to quote here, increased pressures, high demand and high clinical risk. So that means essentially if you start moving children from Temple Street, Crumlin, into the premises at St James's, in the middle of the winter, you're going to be short on staff, you're going to have overcrowded hospitals, you're going to have overworked staff as well, whether they're in ambulances, A&Es, or wherever. And the report also points out that none of the other more recent developments in the children hospital world, if you're looking at, there's hospitals have opened in Perth, Edinburgh, Glasgow in recent years, none of those opened in the winter. But because of the public and political pressure on the board behind this, they're now considering, well, maybe we'll just take that risk, which is extraordinary, really.
So previously the controversy was focused on, it was starting at 700 million, it's up to two and a quarter billion, and the outrageous cost. Mm. But now, even having paid for it, we're not going to get it.
We're not getting
until
it.
Until 27,
no,
perhaps.
But it's more even that it's moving in the direction of the people responsible for developing this thing are going, will we put the kids at risk, despite being told
that it is anyway, after spending all this money to make a new premises. And if you look at the picture in the Sunday Times, it is tangible now because you can see it. It's a huge building. It's very impressive looking. If it ever gets open, it should be great. But it's now come to the point that people are at their wits' end. They can't get this thing over the line, can't get it finished. And now they're considering, will we put the kids at risk anyway?
Yeah.
Just to get it open.
And just to say, we, as always, between now and 12, welcome your interactive comments. Text line is as usual, 53106 at a cost of 30 cents. Or if you're a cheapskate like myself, you can do it for free at 087 1400 106, our WhatsApp number. Pat, this raises the question, a big row this week about Metrolink. And you know, being involved in the property sector, that the precursor to property development is infrastructure delivery. Are we starting to get this right? You see Jack Chambers' interview. This time, will it be different?
Yeah, I mean, it's just the perennial Irish curse, almost, like we just don't do infrastructure well. We're excellent at crisis management. We did really well during COVID. We did really well during the financial crash. But it kind of posed the question, are we very good at crisis? Because we have these crises because we don't plan very well. And Jack is putting it up there in the Business Post. He's saying that, you know, he's not going to take any prisoners here. I think both the politicians and the civil servants both need to be much less risk averse. And he certainly is making all the right noises. And if he pulls this off in terms of creates a whole new culture and a whole new step change in terms of delivery of infrastructure, it will underscore his future political career. And obviously, if it doesn't, it will be a big challenge for him. But I think we have to get this right because, I mean, it's impacting across every part of the economy. We've seen the issue at Amazon pulling a project.
This is a 300 million project in northwest Dublin.
Yes. And then we've had the ongoing sag of how we get the water from the Shannon to Dublin, which is badly needed. And we have an issue with houses not being connected to electricity because we don't have the infrastructure, we don't have the substations, we don't have the transformers. So it's a huge issue, and it's probably alongside housing, because they're twins, really, the biggest political issue of the day, and we have just simply got to get it right for our economic future, for our social future.
John, the civil service take on this, well, first of all, I'm smiling at the fact, you know, you can't sack anyone in this country unless you pay them 2 years' salary. But if you take something like Bikegate, you know, and then there's a hue and a cry, how did this cost 400,000 or whatever it was? The civil servants, their first instinct is to cover their own ass. Well, what's your take in terms of the civil service performance and specifically about the National Children's Hospital?
Well, look, you know, let's look on a positive. In 2008, the economy crashed, you know, went crash, bang, wallop. And you know what? We got ourselves out of it. We don't seem to be able to actually launch a hospital, and we don't seem to be able to do lots of other things. In particular, people are crying out for houses, not particularly for apartments. I think a smaller group of people would like apartments and be very happy there. But, you know, what I can't understand is we've a big government at the moment. We've a lot of ministers in government, as there have been in previous governments. So I just don't understand why we're not getting results at the moment. And it's really, really serious because, you know, if people don't have houses to live in, a lot of them are just going to flit away and gradually find that they can get homes in other countries and in other countries.
Actually, there's one very interesting statistic. There's a report out commissioned by the Hardware Association that home ownership for people under 40 has never been lower in the history of the state. It's quite striking. Philip, you know, this week also saw two big beasts, Michael O'Leary and Dermot Desmond, wade into what is perhaps our biggest, like, if the National Children's Hospital is 2 billion, like, I've seen estimates of Metrolink of up to 24 billion.
Yeah, I'm sure.
And without private funding, I don't think it's going to happen. Where do you think Metrolink stands right now?
Well, they're throwing money at it. I can't think of the figure off the top of my head, but a lot of
2 billion in the National Development Bank, but that's for design.
No, but money, 2 billion for consultancies and whatever else has been going on over the last 10 or more years. So, look, I personally think it is needed. I'm not sure about this revolution of driverless cars that Dermot Desmond says is going to replace the need for any kind of transport. I think it is kind of odd. getting off, like we're such an international hub, Dublin Airport is, whether it's from people coming here to go for holidays and things like that, business, or jumping on elsewhere, that we don't have a metro that you can just jump on. Like every
we're the only capital city in Europe that doesn't have a modern mass transit system.
It just seems
and we have a shorter timescale solution as well, which is the Lewis. If you put a Lewis going from Dublin city centre to most of the large town areas on the outskirts of Dublin, say about 12 Lewises, you would actually be able to live with much better public transport while you're building the metro. And I don't understand really the comments of the two billionaires. I mean, they're important comments, but, you know, how much do they use public transport in practice? Or is it once a year or maybe once a decade event for them?
Michael O'Leary famously bought himself a taxi plate.
Yes,
so he could use
the bus lanes.
We need a massive investment in public transport, and we do need the metro. And if you think about it, the North City offers a solution in terms of a huge amount of undeveloped land in that section of the city for housing. And the thing that's missed about the metro, it's always framed by the opponents as being some kind of a link between the airport and the city, as if there was nothing in between. There's going to be about 20 stops. It's actually, what you need to do is you develop the metro north, and then you actually densely develop the whole corridor along the metro, where there's a lot of zoned and service land, and you can actually be transformation in terms of...
John's point there about one of the only projects, public transport project, that was delivered on time and in budget was the extension of the Lewis to Bloomfield. Yep. And they plan to extend it to Finglas. Like, Lewis has been extraordinary, the Green and the Red
Absolutely.
Line, an extraordinary
very
success
good.
Story.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah.
It's very good. I mean, I'm a user of public
too,
transport and... where would you be without it and the buses? And the bus service is reasonably good. But just going back to the housing one, you know, are we satisfied from the various comments of ministers that actually they've command over the water services and the electricity service and the other services that are essential? You know, we seem to have lost touch with the fact that if you build a block of apartments, right, you can't put anybody in any of them till the whole apartment block is completed. So what we're hearing, even from North County Dublin, you know, where I would have served on the council in my time as a councillor, where are the water services? Where are the electricity services and the other services that you can't complete houses without? Yeah. And you certainly can't complete apartments.
Your eye was taken. Tony Reddy, a Reddy Architects, one of the largest in the country, a very prominent guy, and he's done an awful lot on compact design and other things. He has a piece in, was it the Business Post? He gives five solutions to it. Talk us through it.
Yeah, he's setting out what he says can be the delivery of 1.2 million new homes by 2024 if the government follows the
2024,
path. 2040.
We're going back in time.
Yeah. Sorry.
By when?
2040, he says. Okay. So not too far away. Essentially what he is looking for, and I think this is kind of the work of the Land Development Agency, is to establish urban development zones where you go, these are areas in Dublin, Cork, Limerick, and these are going to be filled with new houses. There's going to be, you bring together the various different elements, the various different stakeholders, let's say, into a task force. And then they master plan the whole thing. He's big into treaty master plans and things like that. And then you set it out and you just push it forward. But
on the continent, they do these master plans. Yeah. And once it's decided, this is where it's going, right?
No judicial reviews.
Where the difference in Ireland is we have a civil law system that if someone... in the case of Clonliffe, religious heritage, or someone else doesn't like a big whopping tower beside them or whatever, they have a civil right to go. Whereas it's a statute law system on the continent.
Well, look, going back to what, and you were a politician, Joan, you were a politician as well. Like, politicians legislate and they get their mandate from the people. And then they empower planners, like on board Pinola, Commission Planu, to make decisions. And these are experts and they are... you know, skilled in the whole area of planning and development. And then we have a court system which comes along subsequently and second guesses them. And my thinking would be that if you, as legislators, give these people the mandate, they should have the sway on planning matters. And once it's gone through the process of consultation, whatever, then it should hold.
But we had 900 pages of a planning bill and act. And the sort of best they could come up with to stop people taking these legal cases, because they get an award of cost if they pick one slug, yeah. one snail, one fawn, was to cap the legal fees at 35 grand.
Yeah.
You're in the front line of this because you represent the people who, once the thing is built and has a rent roll or in terms of development, would push 10 billion a year into this. What are they saying to you about the planning system?
They're literally frustrated with the whole planning system because, I mean, and it's not just, like, it applies to renewables, climate change, public utilities. Everything is bedeviled by the current planning system. And I actually think at this stage that the new Planning Act is going to take about 2 or 3 years to actually get effect. So in terms of a lifetime of this government, I don't think it's going to do anything for the government in terms of its ambition to scale up the housing numbers. So I actually would be now advocating that we need to introduce emergency planning powers for a short-term targeted transitional period, because I actually think that a 900-page planning bill and all the intricacies and complexities of it is going to take a long time to get off the runway. And in the meantime, I think we're going to have to take short-term emergency measures. Yeah. I don't know whether they're constitutional issues, but...
That's what I was going to say. What about having a referendum on it and saying, like, let's re-examine the rights of property in the Constitution and see what people want? Really?
Well, to be honest, I think that's well meant, but I don't see that working. I think what people want to see are actual buildings on estates, houses, homes, apartments.
Unless it's near their home.
And that's what they're not actually seeing. So I think there needs to be a lot of conversations. And you also have now, coming up to the next budget, a certain amount of special pleading of giving builders basically more breaks. But what's the point of more breaks if they can't even deal with the water issues and they can't deal with the service issues? Because
on that specific, so there's 25,000 apartments, principally in Dublin City and some in Cork, that have planning permission, but they're not being built because of what's called affordability and viability. Okay? I have seen, and I've seen you on LinkedIn, Pat, saying that maybe for a fixed 2-year period, for a certain set of apartments, to have a VAT rebate system like they did for capital development charge. What is the proposal here?
Well, first of all, I completely accept the point that Joan made that unless you have services, you shouldn't be giving further breaks because it's a nonsense. I mean, you can't get the connections. But if you take all of those apartment developments, they're in the city. They're sitting in amenity-rich, service-rich locations. So you have the water, you have the electricity, everything's there. But there is a viability problem. And the viability problem is around the cost of construction of apartments, and they're well chronicled. I'm not going to go through them here again.
But some of the design specs, the dual aspect, that kind of thing, the minister has announced that. That's all helpful.
But there is also a need to reduce the input costs. And the only way you can do that in the short term is actually to reduce VAT on apartment development, because at the moment it's 13%. In the UK, there's zero VAT. And in a lot of other countries, the VAT rate is lower. They've done it before for other sectors. They're contemplating doing it again for the tourist industry. I think for a short-term period to try and restore viability for those developments that are ready to go and have the amenities, have the water, have the electricity, I would say, argue that you need to actually reduce the input costs.
There's a political problem here. I was speaking to the boss of Ballymore the other day, and he said, Ivan, OK, so say the planning laws or the secondary legislation all comes into place in 26, and now the land is also zoned. I lodge my application. The earliest I'll get planning will be late 27. OK, that's without judicial reviews. And then I need to go build it. When you go through the lag time in this, it'll be 2029. And what's happened in 2029? The election. Is it nearly already preordained that the politics of the housing crisis, which has been with us since 2016, I remember the emergency.
Rebuilding
Ireland, Simon Coveney was appointed. Like, this has been an emergency for a long time. Is the likelihood that smart political people are sort of factoring in now this won't be solved by 29?
Well, we've had the same discussions in the early parts of I'd say, the last three administrations, including this one, all of the last three, that it's like we need to get the housing sorted by the time. I remember there was a discussion before the 2020 election that Fianna Fáil were going to swoop into power and they would take credit for all the great work Fine Gael had done on housing in the previous, since the 2016 election. But in the end, there wasn't too much. And then we had the situation before the last election where they told us we were going to have 40,000 houses built. And so, could this mean
in 2029 we could have a left-wing government? Such would be the dissatisfaction that there will be a seismic
shift?
Well,
if we keep going at the rate that we're going, either a lot of the voters will be gone to another country, much to the upset of their families. Like, people want people to see the world, but they want them to come back to Ireland. And it seems to me that this has become an embedded problem where everyone's afraid to do anything for fear that somebody there or here will be offended. But like, what we have to do is get realistic figures and do it. And we have the money to do it. And as I said, this country survived a very difficult crash of the banks. Yeah. Did that affect housing? Of course it did. And yet all of it came back.
Yeah.
No, so we're able to do it. But we just have to say to ourselves, right, guys, let's go and do it.
I think just one thing here, if the government can start to get the numbers going in the right direction, I mean, we know that the figure is 50,000. It needs to scale up up between now. But I think if the government can actually hit, you know, ground...
I'm trying to do well
arrest
to get 30,000
arrest the decline and then start to get the numbers going the right direction.
There'll be some momentum.
And some of the decisions that have been made are absolutely steps in the right direction. And then it's a question of whether it can happen fast enough.
Okay.
And can I just say as well about the hospital, just very briefly.
Yeah, yeah.
There are so many parents and their babies and their children waiting on that hospital. That, to be honest, it's a bit tragic to hear that the hospital board is not confident about launching the hospital. The hospital looks beautiful. Could they open it to the public and let us see what it's like? And can people say,
and you're so right, because that's what we lose track of. We lose sight of that, actually, the kids and the fact that they need these world-class facilities. Yeah.
You're listening to The Anton Savage Show. Ivan Yates filling in today. My newspaper panel is Joan Burton, Pat Farrell, and Philip Ryan. Up next, we're going to talk about the presidency. It's great to have Joan Burton, Pat Farrell and Philip Ryan with me. Couple of stories about the presidency today. First of all, there's a new name, Gareth Sheridan, who's a 35-year-old pharma guru, a successful investor and entrepreneur. He has thrown his hat in the ring, saying he's had been planning this for a year and talking to councils. Conor McGregor says he's going to take constitutional legal action against the nomination process, which is either 20 members of the Oireachtas or four councils. Still no sign of white smoke from either Fianna Fáil or Sinn Féin. They have said in August they're going to make a decision. And that brings me to the question, Philip. Say they don't have a candidate or kind of are soft peddling on it. Will they use their 949 councillors, of which Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael account for over 400, will they allow, as they did in the last two elections, the Sean Gallaghers, the Peter Caseys, whose only route really is not through the Oireachtas, but through the council? How do you see that evolving in terms of allowing councillors to do it?
Well, it's a difficult one, especially for Fine Gael at this point, because they have their stated candidate. They have a candidate that, according to the opinion polls, is doing quite well. And if the vote was in the morning, could be in with a very, very good chance of becoming the president. And that's, of course, Mairead McGuinness. So will they want to put other people into the field who will potentially damage her chances? I don't know. Also, what are the actual rules, whether they be party or legislatively, around councillors? Can you? I always thought that you couldn't whip councillors for various reasons, especially when it came to decisions on the councils around planning and things like that for our history of corruption at that level.
But well, you are aware, for anyone in Fine Gael or Fianna Fáil, when you go to a convention, you have to sign the party pledge to act in accordance with the whip.
Mm. And, yeah.
Well, like, I remember it back in the day.
Yeah,
but
it comes pre-corruption, though, wasn't it?
So the Labour Party have... So the Soc Dems and People Before Profit put Catherine Connolly out there, and Labour Party in the last few weeks have rolled in by. This has your fulsome support. You have a great track record, Joan Burton, with Mary Robinson, Labour nominee, with Michael Dee, Labour nominee. So you'll be full steam ahead with Catherine Connolly, will you?
Well, I mean, I haven't actually met Catherine Connolly yet in terms of any local sort of campaigns. But my experience of campaigning with Mary Robinson and with Michael Dee is that you really have to get out and meet the people. And there's a special kind of personal, if you like, contact between the candidate and people. Mm-hmm. If that generates and if it grows, people tend to end up, well, I like him or her. and, you know, they'll give them a vote or the vote.
Charisma type of thing. Like the National Plowing Championships, the Common Touch.
But
relatability.
Actually, I think for the presidential election, if somebody is living, say, you know, in rural Clare or, you know, the rural part of Donegal, all of it, what really happens is that people meet the person, get to know something about the person, or people in their family do, and a connection is made. And if the person can, if the candidate can do that, then there's somebody who possibly
but the
is
question,
in with
the
a
question
chance.
I asked you is, how in love with Catherine Connolly, given the row that happened in Galway West in 2006, how committed are the Labour Party to her candidacy, really?
Well, I think the party leader, Ivana Bacik, has indicated that she's very committed. And I think it's for the candidate herself and for people in the party to get to know each other and to then go out
but
and do the business.
But she did say that the Labour Party had lost its soul at the time you were leader.
Well, you know, that's for her to talk about. I mean, she has her views. Let her get out there with her views. But if she wants to get the... Remember, it's not the votes of political parties. The political parties are a road to it. To get on the road of becoming president, you have to go out and talk to people. And you have to indicate what kind of a president you're likely to be. What are the issues you're really going to be involved in and so on. And is that a voice that's missing? Or is a bit latent in Irish politics and needs to grow more. Say, for instance, if your interest was the environment, to give a vision of what it is you as president might contribute to that part of the debate.
The sleeping giant here is Fianna Fáil. You've a bit of a experience in the past. What do you think Fianna Fáil is going to do, Pat? Just personally, what do you think?
Well, personally, I absolutely think Fianna Fáil should be running a candidate. And... I just say it in these terms. The 1937 constitution, which was written by Eamon de Valera, the founder of Fianna Fáil, enabled the presidency and actually created the office of the presidency. So for a party whose founder actually wrote the constitution that created the office of president, not to run a candidate, to me would be unthinkable.
Do you agree with Mary Hanafin?
I absolutely think there should be a candidate. Well, it's not just...
she has made that
point. Who is particularly saying that. Mm. No, but it's actually in one of the papers this weekend. Yeah. Or maybe it was on Saturday that there was a quiet canvas. Some of the journalists spoke to members of the Fianna Fáil Parliamentary Party, and that about 70 or 80% of them, and they had a fairly extensive conversation with people, all felt that there should be a candidate.
They couldn't sit it out. Okay,
yeah.
Well,
no, I think it was a caveat. They should have a credible candidate, and that they, but that they said
well,
there should be a candidate.
There is a ready-made candidate.
But there are names.
The only person in my lifetime who has won three consecutive general elections, getting over 40% of the vote, the most successful electoral politician of our time is Bertie Ahern.
Yeah.
He's, you know, said he's interested. Well, what do you think of him being the Fianna Fáil candidate?
There's
or
Bertie.
Would you say over Micheál Martin's dead body?
No, there... Bertie is out there, or has not indicated that he won't run. He certainly has he's keeping the fire warm, let's put it that way. And you've had Mary Hanafin and you've had Deirdre Heenan has been mentioned, and there's been a couple of others as well. So there's a few names out there, and I think it's up to the leadership of the party and the party itself as a whole to actually take a decision.
But fundamentally,
they must run.
I think Fianna Fáil knows, and Micheál Martin knows well, that the public isn't suddenly going to have a moment of mass amnesia around Bertie Ahern if he puts himself forward again. He has a checkered past. He has been before tribunals. Huge questions about his personal finances still are out there.
We're never answered.
He's refused to answer. He's walked out of interviews with foreign media because they dared to ask him about it. And there is this idea now that, like, look, it's all forgiven. But I don't buy that.
What happens when you run for president? Everything you thought was forgotten about becomes front and centre.
The skeletons are dug out of every cupboard, and there's a lot there from
what
Mr.
about Sinn Féin? What's your take on Sinn Féin? Because my sources in Sinn Féin say that Mary Lou will not be the candidate. She is their most popular candidate, but there's other issues at play. Would it send out a message that she no longer thought she could be Taoiseach? You know, there's downsides if she doesn't make it. What's your sense of Sinn Féin? As a journalist now, what are you hearing about Sinn Féin?
Like, look, I agree with that Mary Lou McDonald will not run. Like, I think she has bigger issues to deal with, and she has a lot of energy to deal with those things as well, and has done well in her current role. Sinn Féin have not done well in presidential elections in this country. Yeah. People forget about with Michael D, but Michael D, essentially, the first time round got elected because everybody else's campaigns
collapsed. Like, it's forgotten that Fianna Fáil had collapsed in the spring of 2011, and they had no energy for it. So he had that opportunity.
And Sean Gallagher was and
Gay Mitchell cabinet. Completely bombed, didn't even get his expenses back. So and then for the re-election, neither Fine Gael or Fianna Fáil took on Michael D. So he really got a free pass twice.
I think the second time round he had built his brand.
The first time was a free pass because
Sean Gallagher really was the nearest.
He did the stuff of going out and campaigning. So whoever the candidate is, they have to present themselves. Like, every voter in a presidential election, in my view, considers themselves a single voter rather than necessarily a kind of party hack. Yeah. They're looking at these people and they're saying, what has he, what has she got to offer? And I think you have to be realistic about that. So really, it's all to play for. And
well,
it may be
that
people
the
they select
yesterday
will
in
come
Wexford.
Out fighting.
Couldn't believe it. 150,000 people throng in the streets. And who was amongst them? Only Michael Flatley. He didn't want to answer any questions about the president, but he was there. And look, he has a culture. He modernised dancing and made it a global product. So he was very,
very
much entitled to be
political
there. But his solicitor made a statement to the courts in relation to his mansion and a legal dispute that is going to have a change in circumstances. And he said within 2 weeks he will be back in Ireland campaigning. That 2 weeks is up. Do you think Michael Flatley will be our next president?
I mean, look, there's so many names out there at this stage, and there's another, month or two to go before we actually get the
names. I think there is an importance to the presidency of Ireland, and that is, in a certain sense, the president, whoever is president, has an oversight of our constitution and our constitutional changes. They also meet the Taoiseach at least once a week and have a look and a chat about what's on the agenda of the Dáil. So it's not a celebrity post. It's actually quite a serious political post, which probably requires a pretty serious person, because to a certain extent you're a bit isolated.
It's also a representative role as a top diplomat.
And you have to be ready to go.
But the bread and butter of the job is being receiving pieces of heavy legislation. I went to the Planning Act, sitting down, reading through them, deciding whether the government have got it right. Does it need to go like that? Like, I don't know if Conor McGregor is going to sit down with the Planning Act or
You also
or
have to sit down.
Who else are Doughty? Maybe Doughty, but are going to read through that type of legislation.
You also have to sit down with the Council of State.
Yes.
That's a very long table with a lot of people around it. And you generally have to spend a full day, depending on what's on at the time, but once a month, a full day going through, as has been said, the recent legislation, like the planning law or any changes. You might even pop down to the children's hospital and say, can I go in here?
Let's have a reality check here. I put it to you that the job is totally titular. I mean, the president is called the Commander-in-Chief. The Minister of Defence decides resources for the army, decides issues of triple lock and neutrality. Like, it is a ceremonial role mostly.
But I think actually the presidency is actually going to be quite important over the next term, because we are living now in a very, very volatile world, and we really badly need to have friends internationally and globally. So we need somebody who can leverage that office in a way maybe it hadn't been on other occasions, to actually...
In what direction?
To project Ireland internationally, to have a head of state, to be able to visit these other countries, to build alliances and friendships with people. Because, you know, the office of Taoiseach can only do so much. I think the presidency can be huge in terms of representing Ireland.
This new guy who's running Gareth Third and trying to run, he's saying, because he's 35, he's going to make issue housing. I mean, is that fundamentally dishonest insofar as that the president will have no say on housing
let's
policy?
Let's be frank, they don't. And I mean, that was what I would think about it. But I mean, I think all the other things that Joan has called out in terms of
embodying the spirit of the nation.
Safeguard in terms of that's really important.
That Ireland is properly represented in whatever the forums of the world are or whenever the issues arise. That's the key thing. If it's somebody who says, oh, I'm not sure about that, what am I going to do?
Do we need to change the nomination system? Because it is really controlled by the parties.
at
yeah,
the moment?
Look, it is. It's very difficult to get on the ticket. It's not like running for, you know, the Dáil, or you can put your name out there, get the nominations, I think, off the public. How many do you need to?
So and this is one of the things McGregor's arguing. He says he has 14,000 signatures. Now, I think the most of those are outside of Ireland. Yeah. But like, is that a way you could do it, that you get 100,000 signatures?
Hold on a minute. We did have a breakthrough in the presidency in the previous occasions where county councils actually came into play. And I actually believe that if somebody was to run as an independent candidate in the election at any time, and that they are somebody of stature and substance that is capable of discharging the functions of the presidency, then they will find a pathway to a nomination. I have absolutely no doubt of that.
Okay,
so I don't think it needs reform, the actual process.
So it's McGregor himself. Can we take his candidacy seriously given the recent court prevailing?
If he gets a nomination, he's as serious a candidate as any other candidate.
But he seems to be making no attempt to use the constitution.
I think one thing we need to watch here is, I mean, I think that county councils don't particularly convene for a specific purpose of nominating for somebody to presidency. They have their scheduled meetings, and there's only one or two left between now and the election. So if somebody's serious about going the route of getting four council nominations, they're going to have
to... Peter Casey wrote to Donegal County Council this
week. They're going to have to get their skates on.
He got
on
that fairly before. Yeah. And you're absolutely right. Yeah. They meet once a month. Yeah. And really, I mean, it's 70 days to polling day.
It's getting very tight. So if somebody's planning to go that route, they need to get their skates on.
Just want to take some texts on some of the things. I agree with Joan. We can't get our act together, re-metro in the Children's Hospital. We are an embarrassment. An educated, well-travelled people, but we've no idea how to plan. Why build, in relation to Metrolink, a lot of views, why not build a monorail, driverless network of routes around the M50 and linear routes? This would have AI to control a fraction of the cost. 3 million would do the city county network. We're not stupid. It's clearly down to the civil service that's long been left unaccountable. Like when you can't be sacked, can't be performance managed, and have a job for life that includes salary increases, regardless of how, if they do sweet F all. How long will spineless politicians allow civil service away with this? Nothing will get done as a result. And it goes on and on and on. A lot of people not agreeing with Michael O'Leary and Dermot Desmond. And they never got a bus to the airport. Metro is the way. Every other European capital has one. And lots more on housing. We need a country of doers. If we had that, we'd be ahead of the curve. Why not copy someone else? My panel in relation to all things in the papers and beyond is Joan Burton, Pat Farrell and Philip Ryan. We'll have more next, including what was Ryan Tubridy doing repaying 150 grand to RTE? Okay, Ivan Yates filling in for Anton. My panel, who has been with me right through, is Pat Farrell, Philip Ryan and Joan Burton. Joan, we've discussed infrastructure, housing, we have a budget upcoming, we've discussed the presidency. What else caught your eye in today's paper?
Well, there was a kind of a sad story in the Sunday Independent about racism and about a family who came to Ireland from India and who've been very badly treated with attacks on their houses and that. And that really shouldn't be us. So I think it is something that we're just going to have to talk to, particularly people going through school now and younger children, and see can we sort this out, because I think it's such a pity. I don't think that the Irish are necessarily inherently racist, but a thing has taken hold among some people, and I think we need to address that.
And could I just make a personal observation on that? And I would say this vis-a-vis the UK as well as Ireland. Of all the migrant peoples, the least aggressive, the brightest, the hardest working are often the Rishis and the Parsis and the Indian community.
Go into any of our hospitals and how many people working in the hospital, whether as nurses or doctors or whatever, are actually from the Indian subcontinent. Quite a lot if people were to do a count, and we rely on them. So I just think it's sad. It's, and as I say, it's covered in the Independent. And racism that used to shock, but that now people seem to have come to expect it.
Yeah, there is a kind of coarseness in public, you know, life that people are gratuitously insulting and racist. Philip, what caught your eye?
I was reading Colin Murphy on podcasts and the rise of the podcast and how it how it essentially is taking over all the various different platforms, whether it be TV, radio, or anything else that we used to watch. But at the same time,
what's the central point he's making? I think he's talking, we've moved from short form,
exactly,
which is interview, Q&A, fairly sharp, yeah, 6 to 10 minutes, to kind of 45-minute more discursive.
Exactly, and even longer again, like when you the likes of your Joe Rogans of the world are sitting around for 3 hours this week with Graeme Linehan, of all people, to talk about, as you can imagine, the thing, only thing Graeme Linehan talks about. But like that, it's the culture and the young people who you would have originally thought, oh, they're only into 30-second TikTok clips.
That's right.
Are like
the attention of a goal, the span of a goal.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That are actually sitting down, putting their AirPods in, and listening to 3 hours.
I think what's made podcasts is, and because you have your podcast and I have Path to Power with Matt Cooper and so on, that people. So I fill in for Pat and so on, but you actually have to be within a radio between 9 to 12 Monday to Friday. Mm. Whereas if I go for a walk on a Sunday, I can listen to The Rest is Politics, I can listen to any podcast. So they're very user-friendly for people who are in a gym or whatever at the time of their choice. The same way that the player for television is displacing the TV schedule.
What it can't do is live events. And I was here with you on election day last year.
Yeah.
And it was News Talk's full day of coverage of the election, informing people on how the counts are going, interviews with the protagonists and the people who were successful or unsuccessful. Podcasts can't do that.
No.
I remember during, I think it was last year, there was a tweet going around during the British local elections where some, presumably a Gen Z or X or whatever they're called these days, saying, wouldn't it be great if there was a podcast that could cover live events?
Yeah.
And it was like, well, you'll never guess, there actually is.
In media terms, it's called radio.
Sorry, the conclusion that Colin is drawing is that this is a fad or what?
No, that this is becoming a bigger thing, that we have to realise that the podcast, it does give people a bit more, and it gives more time to
and of course the biggest
out
podcasters
issues.
Are traditional media. Newspapers have podcasts, News Talk and RTE have podcasts.
But then you have the kind of more celebrity driven ones, whether it is
Vogue Williams,
Vogue and Joanne McNally.
And you can have crime ones.
Crime are big, huge.
But it's an and rather than an either, and it's just evidence of like how
more fragmentation,
growth we've had in media, like the number of platforms, the number of local stations, all the platforms that are now available I mean, actually, at some stage, I think you'll probably get a platform that'll actually seek to kind of distill all of that kind of stuff and sort of put
so what caught your eye, Pat?
Yeah, Jim O'Callaghan, actually, Shane Coleman on page 19 on the Business Post. And it is just, he's talking about how sure-footed he has been in his ministry for the last 7 months. And it's related to how the whole racism thing is, it's just so ugly and horrible. And yet, you know, then you get people hijacking the whole asylum story.
He has changed the tone. More deportations.
But he has done it in a nuanced way without actually aggravating that debate, and at the same time has tackled maybe some of the touch points around it that have fed into that.
Well, there's one
anti-racism
thing.
Narrative.
There's one thing as well that he's done.
A racism narrative, I should say.
He said to people, generally to the public, that people are going to be charged for the cost of their iPass stay. Now, if you're listening,
you call him Brophy Junior Minister like 288 a week.
If you're listening to complaints, which really are about new people coming in here, there is a feeling abroad that people are getting everything for free. I think he's trying to change that narrative by saying we're charging for services that you use if you have a job and if you have some money. I would think for a lot of older people that would possibly stabilise the situation a bit, because it would feel fairer.
OK, we have a few minutes left. I just want to go to this text. Ryan Tuberty was completely shafted. The rest are all off on huge payouts after not performing, and he performed brilliantly every day and is paying a bill for a ridiculous way of payment that RTE instigated. It's absolutely incredulous. However, will you ask your panel what happened to the tax element of the 150 grand? He would have paid tax on the first 150k. Is he doubly out of pocket now? So, but what was your take? Because there's in today's papers, Philip, there's quotes from RTE staff saying that there would be hell and fury if he was taken back.
Yeah, I think like there's a huge amount of PTSD probably out in RTE at the moment. Once, especially throughout that entire scandal, which went on for months and months, like there's the average worker there who used to be very proud to be able to tell people, I worked in RTE and isn't it great? I'm out in Donnybrook and I've met this person and that person. And then they were kind of holding their heads in shame going, Christ, they've been...
But the 725 million of a bailout helped.
Well, that's helped. They've actually
increased. Like, they had 1,900 staff, they've even more now. I mean, what do you make of Ryan Tubridy? Do you think he has been ill-served, or do you think he's got his comeuppance, or what do you think?
There was a much wider issue in RTE, obviously, as we now know, through the whole appearances at the committee and around governance, stuff like that. But Ryan became the lightning rod for it. So to that degree, I think... While there were issues, I mean, he became part of the collateral damage in it. Why has he paid back the 150,000? I think he probably just did it because he just wants to move on and get rid of it, because it was the one issue that was hanging there from that particular period.
But at the same time, he's looking for all this documentation from RTE. Which people think maybe is that.
I think, funnily enough,
more sinned against or sinning.
No, but I just think what was funny in a way was here were these famous broadcasters, absolutely top of the tree, and yet they weren't able to deal cleverly, if you like, with the Doyle Committee. So they got roasted by the Doyle Committee. They got roasted. I mean, honestly, if they forgot, you know, to pay their bus fare,
but surely the key point is that the malaise of RTE is much the global changes in audiovisual, the challenges, the independent productions, the whole nature of the digital revolution. It means that RTE, as it was a heritage national flagship station, the same as airlines, is just not going to...
But then those Jane O'Lore figures come out and it seems like half the country's listened to the radio.
I mean, we just have more...
Ivan, you know, I know as well as I do that in the Doyle and in the Shannon, there's a longing to be on media very often by pretty much everybody. But... quite a lot of people are very nervous about it. So when committees then get a chance to really they can do a big job.
Do you remember Rehab and PAC? People made their reputations.
But Ivan, you've rightly called out all the challenges and the new platforms. But like what I observe is that Just Media is growing, 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 and we are consuming more and more and more of it. So rather than there being a displacement where...
But that doesn't mean it's all monetized, Pat. In other words, the fact of the matter is, just because you provide a service doesn't make it economic.
Yeah, and that's the law of I suppose, competition. Some will survive and some will prosper. But I mean,
there is
a bigger market for media. What? Has anyone made a podcast of the hearings? That was certainly live in your bus.
Sounds like another snowfest to me. But anyway, my sincere thanks to the former leader of the Labour Party, Joan Burton, Pat Farrell, who is still CEO of the Irish Institutional Property Association, and Philip Ryan, who is head of content at Sunday Times Ireland.
The Anton Savage Show on News Talk.